On the line with us right now is, thank you, sir, is Gara Perovitz. He is the Lionel R. Bauman Professor of Political Economy at the University of Maryland and a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution. You might remember Gar was on our show a couple of years ago when he had his book out, Just Desserts. Gar served as a legislative director in both houses of Congress and as a special assistant in the State Department. He is the president of the National Center for Economic and Security Alternatives and is a founding principal of the University of Maryland-based Democracy Collaborative, a research institution developing practical, policy-focused, and systematic paths towards ecologically sustainable, community-oriented change and the democratization of wealth. He was the architect of the first modern steel industry attempt at worker ownership, and his 2005 book, America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy, has just been re-released with a new foreword and introduction. You can purchase that book by just going to Gar's site. All you have to do is just click on his name at our site, and it takes you directly to his site. Good morning, Gar.
Hey, good morning.
Thanks so much for being back on our show, sir.
Oh, glad to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Sure, and I really appreciate your flexibility on your schedule. We were trying to accommodate somebody in Hawaii this morning. Before we even get into your book, before we get into any of your writing that you have at your site, and people should be checking that out on a regular basis, garalperovitz.com, GARALPEROVITZ. I just wanted to take this opportunity to ask you about this right to work thing that happened this week. Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels of Indiana, who had once said that he opposed a right to work provision to the state's labor laws, signed a bill on Wednesday that enshrined right to work as the law of the land in Indiana. Indiana's the 23rd state to put a right to work law on the books, but the first in the Rust Belt. The way that the New York Times describes right to work legislation is like this. The legislation bars unions, union contracts from requiring non-union members to pay fees for representation and makes Indiana the first state in more than a decade to enact right-to-work legislation. Now, I have a great quote from Governor Daniels on this exact topic that I want to dissect with you later. But before we do that, what can possibly be so wrong with a bill that gives workers the right to work without being forced to join a union and isn't being forced to join a union or forced to pay union fees, taxation without representation? Of course, this is a devil's advocate question, but what's wrong with right to work?
Well, obviously, what happens is that the union puts all the effort into achieving a bargaining contract and protecting the rights of workers, and being part and parcel of that is the entire idea of the union structure. I mean, we've had union bargaining since the 1930s as an official law of the land, and to simply exempt people and give them a free ride is just to undercut. I mean, what's really going on here? Let's be clear. The conservative and the right-wing groups are trying to go in on the kill for the union movement in general. This is an all-out attack, just like the Wisconsin attacking the public service workers, and in Indiana and in Ohio. They see that the labor movement has been weakened. It's gone from about 35% of the labor force at the peak in the mid-1950s. It's now down to about 11%, 6.9% in the private sector. And they're out to kill the unions, both for economic reasons, but also because it's a key part of the political muscle behind the progressive democratic causes and the Democratic Party in general. These are really important attacks and really need to be challenged.
The implication within a law called right to work is that unions are somehow obstructing workers' right to work. Is there any way in which unions hurt the ability of a worker to get a job?
Not from my perspective at all. In fact, it preserves their right to, they can easily be, without the union, they could be dumped and fired without notice in many parts of the country. They have almost no right to protect themselves against management prerogatives. The union is the defense and the barrier for people in the workplace.
After signing the new right to work law in Indiana, Governor Daniels said, quote, 7 years of evidence and experience ultimately demonstrated that Indiana did need a right to work law to capture jobs for which, despite our highly rated business climate, we are not currently being considered. The law won't be a magic answer, but we'll be far better off with it. Will right to work bring new jobs to any state? It's now in 23 states, but will it bring jobs? Is it guaranteed? Is there evidence that shows that right to work brings jobs to the states where those laws have been passed?
I'm not on top of the latest research in this area, but my impression is that that so many other factors are at work besides the labor law that brings companies in. On the other hand, going to very low labor cost states is clearly what many corporations want to do, playing states off against each other. And it traditionally going into the South until very recently was the strategy because they could force wages way down irrespective of labor contracts.
Okay, so let's say it does bring jobs. What kind of jobs does it bring to a state?
Well, indeed, what you're getting, it sometimes brings industrial jobs, but in fact, manufacturing has been going down, down, down. As you know, we're now at 9% of the labor force in manufacturing.
Right.
And you're often looking at low-wage jobs and again, undercutting labor unions and thereby undercutting the political process.
Governor Daniels also said, quote, "I respect those who have objected to right-to-work laws, but they have alarmed themselves unnecessarily. No one's wages will go down, no one's benefits will be reduced, and the right to organize and bargain collectively is untouched and intact. The only change will be a positive one. Indiana will improve still further its recently earned reputation as one of America's best places to do business, and we will see more jobs and opportunity for young people and for all those looking for a better life." So do you believe wages will drop, benefits will be cut, and labor organizing and collective bargaining will both be undermined despite what Governor Daniels said?
That's the most likely trend when you look at what's happening in other states, and that's why they're doing it.
This is just an attempt to try to end unionship.
Yeah, reduce it radically, end it, cut it back, and give a free rein to corporate power. I think that is the larger trend. And it has, had very powerful implications beyond the fact just that people in Indiana and Wisconsin and Ohio are going to be really under attack. We're talking about the end of a political economic era. I mean, the way in which the American political economic system, and this is really the heart of the America Beyond Capitalism book that we're talking about, the end of an era in which labor unions were sufficiently strong to back some form of Democratic Party policies and some progressive legislation. Without strong labor, without the muscle and money of organized labor, civil rights legislation, feminist legislation, even environmental legislation, that is electing congressmen and congresswomen who would vote for progressive strategies in general, without the labor movement, that whole strategy becomes extremely weak and you don't have a balancing power against corporations. And that's a systemic crisis. That's what's happened in America as labor's gone from 34% down to 11% and declining. And so we're entering a period, not just a political crisis, but these attacks on labor represent a systemic crisis, ending the kind of countervailing power that kept the system in line. So I think we're either going to develop a different way of going about this. And, you know, the book America Beyond Capitalism is about that. Other ways to develop both as much as we can with labor to the extent we can. Of course, building up labor is very important to the extent possible, but they're really under attack. We're going to have to go into really changing the ownership and of really industry and jobs and companies, and I think that's what's interesting. A lot of that's happening just below the surface that the press hasn't caught up with, and a good part of the book is really all about what the press isn't covering in terms of worker-owned companies, cooperatives, municipal banks that are being owned by the states, public ownership in general, changing who owns capital. And I think that's the quiet trend that slowly is beginning to build and needs to be attended to.
We're speaking with political economist Garel Parovitz. You should check out his book. Again, the title of it is America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. It's published by Democracy Collaborative Press. But you can just go to Gar's website. Just go to our site, click on his name. It takes you directly to his site where you can purchase the book. Again, Gar's site is Garel Parovitz. GARALPEROVITZ.com. You touch on this in your book. You touch on this in some of your writing at your site. But to what degree have we outgrown unions, or to what point have unions evolved to a point where they are no longer the end all and be all for workers' rights?
Well, that's the critical distinction. And I might say, since it's hard to spell my name, if you go to AmericaBeyondCapitalism.org, you get there too.
Okay, all right, AmericaBeyondCapitalism.
One word, .org, yeah. As I was saying, I think what people need to realize is that a whole kind of 20th century history of how the system was run, that is giant corporations, in part balanced by labor unions and also balanced politically by the force of labor unions, that is what's dying before our eyes. And what the right wing is trying to do is to drive a stake through the rest of it by these right-to-work laws and the attacks on public service employees around the country. And they are, in fact, succeeding in that attempt. It is highly unlikely that we will ever build the labor movement union organizing, much as I would like to, back to the 30% and 40% range. You know, in Europe and in Sweden, it was 85%. That's why you were able to get a progressive welfare state in Sweden. Here, at best, we were 34%. So that whole system of balancing is in decay, and it's very, very, the right-wing politics you see represents that. And what's interesting is either we build a whole new way to build institutions, not simply political campaigns, but real institutions like labor, which had money and muscle to support people, or that trend's going to continue. And, you know, why I wrote America Beyond Capitalism is on the ground, if you look carefully, and the press doesn't cover any of this, there are numerous people, 130 million Americans, 130 million, that's 40% of the society, are involved in one or another form of co-ops that can be expanded and developed into significant scale operations like the Mondragon co-ops in Spain, which are, you know, very high-tech, very advanced technology, 85,000 people involved and doing new research. They're not your little mom and pop's co-ops the way people usually think of it. There's in Cleveland right now, there's a very interesting set of worker co-ops have been developed, in part looking at the fact that hospitals and universities can't get up and leave, and also they've got a lot of taxpayer money in, you know, healthcare and education. Well, in this particular part of Cleveland, just one section, they buy $3 billion of goods and services. And the light bulb went on. Why couldn't they buy not only from locally, but set up worker-owned companies that would begin to supply them? And that's exactly what's happening in Cleveland and beginning to happen in several other cities as people wake up to the fact we've got to build new institutions that change who owns wealth, change who owns capital. And that's the kind of thing that's happening on the ground just below the radar. The press doesn't cover it all, but I try to cover some of it in the book.
Yeah, people got to check it out. Again, AmericaBeyondCapitalism.org. You can find the book right there. One of the things I kept thinking about while you were saying how the media just doesn't cover this is years and years, maybe 8 years ago, we were talking to Norman Solomon on the show, and he said, "Do you ever notice that there's a business section in every paper, but they never discuss labor, and there's never a labor section in any newspaper?" And I think that just reflects the way in which the media so often views the world through the eyes of the powerful, and the powerful being those at the top and the wealthiest, and not through the eyes of the majority, you know, not through the eyes of the 1% rather than the 99%, as they
exactly
say. Do you think that these that kind of own, because I really love this idea of worker ownership in the United States, and you give a lot of really great examples of worker ownership here in the United States. The Occupy movement, the Occupy Wall Street movement, was very upset. One of the things they were upset about were the traditional liberal organizations that were supposed to be defending their rights, like unions, and how they'd slipped over the years, and how they weren't being as confrontational as they should have been, how they weren't defending the rights of workers as much as they should. How much of a challenge do these worker ownership models face when it would seem like they might be maybe a threat to labor unions, but more so they'd be at least a competition to big money corporations who may not like this idea of a worker ownership model that's from the ground up instead of the top down?
Well, it's very interesting because originally some labor unions, you know, go back to the Knights of Labor in the 19th century, and their whole strategy was all about building worker ownership of the means of production, worker-owned companies. That's where they started. And now many labor unions have realized that the steel workers, for instance, used to be against this when I did the work in Youngstown with the steel industry. Now the steel workers internationally are supporting worker ownership as a whole strategy for the new era. That's a big development. So, and many unions are now, you've even seen unionized ESOPs and unionized worker-owned companies. So there's a whole quiet development that's building up around the country that people just aren't aware of yet. The way to think about this, though, and this is the hard place in all this, you know, my heroes are the civil rights workers in Mississippi, but in the 1930s and 40s. Now, I certainly have great admiration for those in the 1960s. But this is a long decade-by-decade struggle of laying the foundations for a whole new kind of systemic change. Because if labor continues to decline, and it is likely as unions are declining, we are either going to build the basis of a new system, that is worker ownership, changing the ownership on the ground, municipal ownership, there are 2,000 public utilities, 25% of American electricity is produced by co-ops and municipally owned, so you could call the socialized sector. There are state banks, really changing who owns things from the ground up. And also nationally, you know, we did nationalize Chrysler and GM, and as soon as the public made some money out of it, they gave it away. At some point, those companies could be doing mass transit when the next crisis comes in and building a high-speed rail. Some of these big New York banks, I think they're going to have another financial crisis. They'll probably try to break them up. And then when the big fish eat the little fish and regroup at some point, turning one or two of those into a public utility, I think that direction has to be built. But the way to think about it is not one piece of legislation tomorrow and it's all over. This is commitment for the long haul to really rebuild the basis of the next system, the America beyond capitalism, or the one to replace the counterbalancing system. Do as much as we can with unions, obviously, but they are on the defensive. And they need bolstering with other institutions. That's the argument of the book.
Right, but you say that you have to be in for the long haul for this. If we have these, you know, terms that end 2, 4, 6 years, and that people who are either in Congress or in the Senate or are even president of the United States are concerned about their campaigns 2, 4, or 6 years down the road at the very, very most, how much is our ability to move forward with a brand new long term system, how much is that ability undermined simply by the political system that we have?
Well, that's why it's important to not look to, I mean, Congress elected officials at the national level, that's the last place to look, I think. Look at the local level. That's what's interesting. The pain is increasing locally, like a city like Cleveland's gone from 800,000 to 400,000. The neighborhoods we're talking about have 40% unemployment and family income of 18,000. Either you start building locally where people really realize there's enormous pain and slowly building up from the ground up. You don't go to Congress, it's probably the last place you go. On the other hand, Sherrod Brown, the senator, is introducing legislation to support this kind of development around the country. So we've got some people in Washington on our side as well. But what you're seeing starts at the grassroots level, and it begins in the localities and in the states. 15 states have introduced legislation to have state-owned banks, just like the one that's been operating in North Dakota. Another 15 states have introduced legislation to have single-payer health care. Again, starting where you can start, building up from the bottom up. And that's how a movement has to be seen that way. And the argument of the book, America Beyond Capitalism, is, yes, do whatever you can in electoral politics. Hold the line wherever possible. But the real action is for people who are committed to the long haul, rebuilding in their own communities. Interesting piece of this, by the way, some of the 60s generation, the old 60s generation, people just beginning to retire who actually have got time, and they've learned a lot, some of them have business skills and economic skills, they've got time, they've got some commitments. They're kind of the folks who can really be very helpful in kind of providing assistance with the development while the younger Occupy movement begins building. There's an interesting group of people available with time and skills and contacts and commitments who could be part and parcel of this movement that's already happening at the grassroots level.
Just like the people who are in the Occupy Wall Street movement now 30, 35 years down the road can continue that institutional memory and legacy of telling people how to organize and what they can target, correct?
Exactly. That's exactly the idea. But I think where we're moving now is into institution building as well as political challenges and occupies and protests. That's the new dimension, getting into, you know, getting our hands dirty with building up collective organizing. You know, 1%, the latest figure that is really staggering, you may have seen this figure, 400 people at the top, 400 people. Michael Moore found this out, but it's been checked by several statisticians. 400 people own more wealth in America than the bottom 185 million Americans taken together. Unless we change who owns the wealth in the country, obviously the power structure is going to be moving in continuously in the wrong direction. And that's why, and how do you change wealth ownership? you build institutions like worker-owned co-ops, like land trusts, like state banks, like city utilities, like land trusts that are common, publicly owned land in many cities. That kind of grassroots rebuilding of the whole basis of the society in a very decentralized and kind of democratic way, democratizing wealth, that is the power base. Unless we change who owns wealth, we are not going to change the system as it decays. But the hopeful sign is that the pain levels itself, and you know, again, that's what America Beyond Capitalism, what the book's about, the pain levels themselves are forcing people to rethink and rebuild and start doing a lot of stuff that the press isn't covering is happening all over the country.
A couple more questions for you. One of the things I was thinking about while I was reading your book was when it comes to this worker ownership model, and you were talking about how it's happening in Cleveland. I started thinking of my own hometown where I was born, Detroit, and how there's a town that's been just completely gutted by the death of manufacturing in the United States. And also, they had a single-mindedness on one industry, and they never diversified, nor did they want to, because that industry was giving them as much power and as much money as they needed. In order for us to have these kind of new long-term ideas that would go from the bottom up, things like worker ownership, does it have to take place after some sort of economic devastation and only in the places that have been the most economically devastated? Is that the fertile ground for these kind of movements?
Well, it's a fertile ground for starting them. But what we've noticed, again, is that Once the idea gets going, other people begin to think, hey, that's not a bad idea. I had a very strange experience in the Washington, D.C. area, at the invitation of a local chamber of commerce, of all places. You know, that's small businessmen. They're being badly hurt, too, by this, what's going on. And I was talking to them, and I mentioned the Cleveland thing, and they said, well, that'd be helpful here. There's one of these big laundry companies. Is a French company. Why should they take all the profits out of the system? We would rather have worker ownership in this area. And that same night, I was talking to radical organizers in Baltimore, and they had the same reaction. At the local level, these ideas make ordinary common sense to people you'd be surprised to if you have a practical illustrations. So yes, Cleveland is probably the most advanced model, but what's happening is several cities, Atlanta, Pittsburgh, Richmond, California, the suburbs of the Washington area, some of the poorer suburbs, they're all beginning to do the same thing because it's a good idea no matter what. And I think it's beginning to spread to larger areas. And I think that's where the challenge is, to take it both in the hard-hit areas, but also why not? Why can't it benefit other areas and just not self-limiting ourselves?
You know, as some people would say that there already is a worker ownership model that has been entrenched within the United States since the 1970s, and that is union members becoming board members of large corporations. I remember this happening with the UAW in Detroit. How is that not worker ownership compared to the model that you propose?
Well, that certainly is not ownership. They give people a kind of a role on the board in some cases with not much power. At least some advisory power, but that, and I'm certainly, it's better than not being on the board. But basically, the ownership stays in the hands of the people with the big dollars, and the unions are always on the defensive, even when they're on the boards of these companies. So it's a small advance, but I'm talking about, and what we need to face is the wealth structure of the United States. Technically speaking, it is medieval in its scope, and I'm not using that in an abstract sense. 1% of the society owns just about half of all of the investment capital. That means the factories, the farms, the mines, all the productive resources of the society. 1% owns just about half. 5% owns 70%. And I said, use the word medieval. That's the way medieval society was organized. The ownership of productive resources, in that case land, was extremely concentrated, perhaps less concentrated than the ownership of wealth here in the United States. Unless you change that in a system, that's inevitably going to dominate the politics. And that's the argument that I think people need to confront. How do we change that? How do we build up over time in a different direction? How do we draw upon what's already being developed and then build a politics around it? I mean, I think politics is going to be critical, but I think we need to have a conception of the content of politics which goes at the heart of the question of who owns the wealth structure or will always be on the defensive.
So is it a mistake then to have this nostalgic look back and think that if we can only hearken back to this era of strong unions, if we can only get union membership up to 10, 15, 20%, that's going to solve all of our problems? Is it a mistake to nostalgically look backward as opposed to what you're suggesting, which is looking forward to a new model?
Yes, I think it is a mistake. Now, remember, I'm a strong defender of the labor market.
Right, right.
Yeah, and so what we've got to do is, wherever we can, build strong unions and hold the line. But I think anybody who takes a hard look at the realities of what's going on now realizes that the labor movement is not likely to go back to those numbers. And hopefully it'll go up a few points. But I don't know anybody who knows what's really going on in the labor movement, either scholars or activists or organizers, who thinks we're going to get back to the power levels that once dominated, you know, 35% at the mid-century, which was weak, by the way, by international standards. I mentioned most European countries were double that, or some of them were double, some were in the 50, 60% range, some up the 85% range. But we, at best, were 35%. So I think we're not going back there. And once we face that, then do whatever we can on the labor front. But unless we build a whole set of new institutions from the ground up that have rooted power in the communities, change who owns the wealth structure, I don't think we're going to get back to a politics. And that's a long, long fight. And it's a systemic change. It means changing who owns kind of wealth and power. That's a long fight, and big fights both at the local level and when the crises hit at the national and state level, beginning to think about, just as we did, we nationalized a couple big car companies. A whole different way of thinking about a long-term fight, and I think yes, we're going to have to do that, and we'll see how far we can get. Minimally, this direction helps a lot of people as you go forward, as in the Cleveland model, and many other parts of the country. That all these co-ops that are developing out of the pain levels. Minimally, you help a lot of people. Beyond that, you begin to build a power base. And beyond that, potentially begin to have a whole transformative vision of where the system ought to go down the line over the next 3-4 decades. And systemically, what is the vision of a different society in which wealth benefits the people rather than these tiny, tiny, tiny percentages that own most of the productive wealth?
Just two more questions for you, Gar. Everybody should be checking out AmericaBeyondCapitalism.org, not only to get Gar's book, but also to see his most recent writing. He posts his articles there as well. There's an art, and those articles are definitely worth reading on a very regular basis. And I want to quote not only your book, but also an article that you posted there. You write, "The developmental trajectory from Youngstown to today illustrates what might be called forced institutional innovation, a process that once underway also suggests further possibilities for larger scale and more refined development, both within Ohio and elsewhere, especially as many other parts of the nation now experience the massive job losses and community decay that hit Ohio and other Rust Belt states 3 decades ago. Critically, all involve new ways to give concrete meaning to the idea of democratizing capital." In the new introduction to America Beyond Capitalism, again, you can find that at AmericaBeyondCapitalism.org, you write, "Few readers were willing to accept the central argument of the 2005 first edition of that book, that beneath the surface level of politics as usual, it is by no means clear that the public is or will remain quiescent forever, especially if social and economic pain continues, if political elites continue to overreach, and if new directions begin to be clearly defined." Now, that was the point of your 2005 book, but what has struck me about the aftermath of the financial collapse of 2008, and what seemingly strikes writer Thomas Frank, who was recently on our show to talk about his new book, Pity the Billionaire, is that social and economic pain has got far worse, that political elites have continued to overreach, amping up their criticism, not just of labor organizing, but of anyone who would question things like wage inequality or anything that the socialist Franklin Delano Roosevelt did that helped drag us out of the Depression. So to what degree have you been surprised by the success of the Tea Party types whose economic revival strategy is nothing more than more of the same tax cuts, cost cutting, and re-regulation that benefits businesses before people that got us here in the first place?
Well, this is the same, another version of the same discussion we're having, because they are now capitalizing on the radical decline of labor. And that it is not surprising. And they are going to go further down that line. There's going to be more cutbacks and more difficulties. And they are now in dominant position, and they are aware of it, and they're trying to move in on the kill. And that's a very hard reality to face. So I'm not surprised at that. That's the existing power structure kind of mobilizing and building upon the trend it has been on, particularly as labor's been weakened both economically and politically, as we've been discussing. That's going to go on. And our problem is to face that and really understand the depth of the systemic nature of the crisis, and then realizing that if you're talking about changing the system, and either rebalancing it the way we did before or transcending it, you're talking about a several decade fight to build from the bottom up and rebuilding. So you've got to face the harshness of it. I'm not surprised at what's going on. You know, if you really want to, you can have models, as I say, of this. I looked at the civil rights workers in the 1930s and 40s who understood that in Mississippi. And they understood it when they could easily be, and in fact often were, hung from a tree for trying to organize. But the women's movement in the 19th century did it decade by decade, state by state, agonizingly to get the vote, because they were facing a major power issue. And they finally succeeded. That's the model that you're talking about if you're talking about very large order change. And people need to get their heads around it. You do what you can do in politics today, obviously, wherever possible. It's almost defensive battles, and mostly are defensive battles. But rebuilding the basis locally and the state level, that's the name of the game. And it's a very hard thing for people to realize that politics has to be at one level in a kind of defensive mode, and wherever you can make advances, fine. And at another level, really rethinking where we're going over time. And that's the argument I'm trying to, you know, get folks to really understand in the book and beginning to think about an America beyond capitalism, which changes who owns all this wealth, productive wealth that the society has produced and has given over to the tiny, tiny elites, the Koch brothers and the other folks at the very top who just grabbed it all off.
Even if you read the 2005 edition, go out and get the new edition of this book. It's got a new introduction. It's got a new foreword. And it's worth rereading, because I'm sure that if you bought the book America Beyond Capitalism, you've loaned it out. And when you loan out a book, you can always kiss it goodbye. Gar, I've got one last question for you. We've been speaking with Gar Alperovitz. He is a political economist. He's got his book, 2005 book, America Beyond Capitalism, has now been re-released. You can get that book, and you can read his most recent writing by going to AmericaBeyondCapitalism.org. Again, the name of that book, America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. One last question for you, Gar, and it's our question from hell. The question we hate to ask, you might hate to answer. Our audience is going to hate the response. I think I'm just going to hate how poorly I wrote this question. What do you mean by America Beyond Capitalism? Do you mean that we can shift beyond exchanging cash for goods and services? Do you mean a kinder, gentler capitalism, or do you mean socialism?
Well, it's very that's a very good question. It's the right question, and that's, you know, if you don't like corporate capitalism and you don't like state socialism, what do you want? And that we've got to face that. And part of the book, America Beyond Capitalism, says those are not the only alternatives. Obviously, the direction I'm talking about has social ownership of capital. So, it can, you know, they call anybody a socialist today, liberals, and, you know, Obama's a socialist. So you can put it on that side of the line, obviously. But the argument that we can't build a new system that is radically decentralized wherever possible, local co-ops, local worker-owned firms, local public ownership of utilities, that sort of thing, and then build up to whatever has to be nationalized, General Motors and Chrysler and the big banks are examples we've got, that we start in a very, very different, you know, America has been a populist nation in that decentralized sense. That's the vision that I suggest. I call it a pluralist commonwealth, plural because worker ownership here, public utility there, nationalized General Motors over here, state banks there. Those are different plural ownership, plural forms of commonwealth. But the vision is radically decentralized wherever possible. And I think that's co-ops and worker-owned firms are the heart of that. And then build up from there. So, yes, that's the direction. But it does mean that you're talking about a different system. It is not corporate capitalism. And it is not state socialism. It's very, very kind of open and democratic and even a libertarian, a communitarian vision of how you own capital, well beyond the traditional models. That's the ultimate vision of America Beyond Capitalism. The minimal step is how do we simply build power that holds back the deluge of the right? And that those two things are really step by step the same. Building new economic power, building new worker-owned companies is positive no matter what. And it may begin to give us the ideas and the outline of a vision of an America that really goes beyond corporate capitalism.
Gary, you used the word libertarian in there, and I just wanted to ask you real quick, you're not a secret Ron Paul follower, are you?
No, but there is a wonderful tradition in both anarchist and socialist thought that's communitarian and very liberty-oriented visions of how you protect liberty in a socialist system. And that tradition needs to be recaptured as well in terms of cooperatives and how they build liberty rather than destroy it.
All right, Guy, I really appreciate you being on the show for the second time. I truly appreciate it. It's great talking to you again, and people got to check out your book, America Beyond Capitalism. They can see it at americabeyondcapitalism.org and read your writing on a regular basis. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Great. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
All right, take care.